And here we are back on this Wednesday, January 29th, 2020, 14 minutes past the hour. The guest is Abby Croman this morning. Don't forget that Charlie Evers is coming up right after this program this morning, and the guest is George Kasotis, 10:10 a.m. till 12 noon. Glenn Coble today, 12:10 to 1 p.m. Offbeat News and Trivia with Nate Redman, 4:10 to 5 p.m. And the Trinity Baptist Church Sunday Sermon is 6:10 till 7 p.m. And a whole lot of other great programming in between. Now, this hour is going to be interesting because, you know, when you meet people, you don't know what things they go through in life and you don't know what things they face. And some people are open books on certain subjects and some people are not. So this hour, we're going to delve into a very personal topic, change gears, because I think it could help a lot of people. And instead of me kind of putting a little synopsis on this, I'm going to let Abby do this. Okay, Abby. So how would you define what happened to you?
I mean, it was life-changing. It was definitely something I never expected my life would go. You know, when you have a plan for your life, and then when you get married and some of that starts to come together, what you think is going to happen and how you think it's going to go, and something comes along and just, you know, totally changes your course, it's life-changing in a lot of ways.
So you were married to a person.
I was married to a person, yes.
Okay, and why did you marry this person?
We instantly had an attraction. We were together for a couple of years before we decided to get married. I don't know. We got along really well. We were totally opposite. Everything about us was different, I think. He was very much a lot of things that I wasn't. Not necessarily in a bad way, just a lot of things that, like, I wasn't, and I think it was intriguing, and I think it was the same way for him. Like, I was a lot more grounded than he was, maybe. He also brought out a fun side of me that maybe that I hadn't had. I don't know. There was just an attraction that was there, I think, kind of instantly.
So how long from the time you met this person was there until you got married?
Let's see. Well, I knew him prior, you know, just kind of from being in the same circle of things. But we probably, it was, let's see, we met in 07, I would say, 2007, and we got married in 2009. So it was a little over 2 years before we got married.
And how long were you married?
We were married just short of 9 years.
So quite a while.
Quite a while.
Mm-hmm. Now, you did have a child with this person,
we
right?
We do. Yep, we have one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, how long was the marriage your typical marriage? A good marriage, but, you know, typical things go wrong.
Oh, yeah. It was pretty typical for, I mean, the majority of it. Just the last couple of years were not good. Maybe there was a little decline in there that I, you know, kind of didn't recognize right away, probably year 6, 7, but it was pretty typical marriage for the first part of it, you know, first 6 or 7 years.
So let's do this. We'll start our way with what the problem was and then work our way back to when you realized it.
Okay.
So for people who are wondering what we're talking about here, right, what was going on? What was his problem?
So at some point, he became an addict. So it started with, as best that I can trace back and really start thinking about it, he became addicted to painkillers. And it progressed really quickly from there, actually.
Now, was it always painkillers, or did other things get involved in the progression?
Oh, in the progression, all sorts of things got involved. And I don't even know if I know the whole, you know, gamut of what he got into. It culminated, it ended in a mixture of painkillers and meth.
Now, would you, looking back on this, have ever thought this was the person who that would happen to?
No, I mean, like, not sort of. I mean, like, he definitely had an addictive personality. I was aware of maybe, not struggles, like things he had done in his past, but he had, you know, gotten past that. That was like that was a kid thing. I never really put, you know, any thought into it. He was a very hard worker. He had a great job. He had a career. You know, he was, although things were good, things were normal.
Did he always maintain his career?
He did. Yeah. He changed courses, maybe a couple years into our relationship. And he got into sales and, he stuck with that and he was good at it. You know, he had a very good income. He worked a lot of hours. So, you know,
So when was the first idea that you had that something was wrong?
It's kind of hard to say. Like, I think I realized things were off, and I remember talking to him about it about a whole year before things became really apparent. But I knew he was off, and I'm like, you know, you need to get a hold of this. Like, I'm not exactly sure what it is, and that's exactly what I said to him. Like, I don't know what you're doing, but it's, you know, it's starting to affect your personality. And he really chalked it up as, like, work. He was working a lot, and he wasn't home a lot, or he was gone, or he was just tired. I mean, and everything was believable because he did work a lot and because he was gone a lot. And so I believed everything that he said, I think, because, well, one, I want to say, oh, you know, it just makes you feel so stupid. Like, oh, how do you miss that? But at the same time, this is this person that, you know, you didn't want to see those things about.
What were you seeing? What were you seeing that made you suspicious?
Well, he would just be, so in the beginning, he would be more tired. So, like, I think the painkillers would initially give him, like, an up, but then he would be just down. So I think that, like, he would, you know, spend literally, like, an entire weekend in bed, or things would kind of, he would get moody. That happened pretty quickly. Just little changes in him that I didn't, that just weren't him. When you live with somebody and you know them that well, I mean, especially, like, you know, 7 or 8 years into our relationship anyway, you know, you can see the little things, I think, that kind of start to go wrong.
So did you ever see the painkillers or any kind of a drug around?
No, I mean, I didn't until I did, you know, until I became more aware, because I started searching. Like, there's a point as it went on and got worse, and you're like, you know, things are, you know, definitely out of hand. Something's definitely changing. Like, I started looking, you know, I became a little detective in my own house, and he was good. Like, he had things hidden. It was never apparent to, the kids or anyone else. It's hard. Like, it's one of those things that, you know, you need to get to the bottom of, but I turned into this person who would just literally ransack my house when he wasn't home, because I had to find things. I had to find answers. And a lot of it, I think, he kept on him or kept in his car. So I would wait until he would fall asleep, and I would start looking for things because I was worried, what he was into, if it was going to kill him. By the time I realized what he was doing, like, I feared for his life more than anything.
So what did you initially, before you, because you say you're ransacking the house, you're looking for things, what are you looking for at this point?
I didn't even know. I mean, like, I don't know what I thought I was going to come across, like, if it was going to just hit me in the face, but, you know, I'm looking for, you know, what am I thinking, like, a pill bottle, or, like, a something that he would hide something in. You know, he had, like, a little tiny chest of drawers that he would just keep little random things, like maybe like his watch, or things would stay in there, and I would always look in there, and I did end up finding things in there that, you know, shouldn't have been in there. There was pills in there. He would keep different things in there. I ended up finding the majority of it. He would hide it in, like, a dip can, you know, because that wasn't a big deal, but that's where he kept things. So, yeah, it was pretty terrible. It's pretty terrible.
So tell me about the day you found the evidence the first time.
Well, that was a pretty terrible day, because the day that I found out, what he was into, the worst of it, when I got up that morning, he was on the couch, and I had actually thought that he was not alive. He looked dead, 100%. He was sitting straight up on the couch, covered in, like, chocolate ice cream, like he had a bowl of ice cream or something on his lap, and, there was just stuff scattered around him, like coins that he'd been looking at, things that he'd been into, and it was awful. It was awful. And I found sitting on next to him on the couch was a little tiny can of it was like a little dip can or something. And I just saw it and I took it. And looking back, that was so stupid. I had no idea what it was. I didn't know what was in it. Touching it alone, as I'm learning more things about, could have been, you know, fatal to me. But I took it and I called a friend and I'm like, I have to talk to you. And she got with me and she was like, holy cow, you know, what are you doing? So I told her everything, which was hard. Only a couple people really knew what was going on. And I was very closed off about it. I didn't talk about it at all. It was one of those things that I didn't want anyone to know about. It's embarrassing, you know, more than anything. I didn't want to be this person, because automatically I felt like if he was into something, then people would start thinking badly of me, or how does she not know, or, you know, it's a really embarrassing thing, or I was very embarrassed by it.
So what did you find in the can?
So it was meth, come to find out. They were like little, I don't know, rocks, if you will, of meth, and it was quite a bit, turns out. Yeah.
So at some point he wakes up. Yeah. What's that conversation like?
I just left. I don't know. He wasn't there. I wasn't home when he woke up. I mean, he ended up calling me. First of all, he wasn't supposed to be home. Like, we were at the point, things had gotten so bad between us that, like, he was supposed to be moving out. It was bad. I mean, I couldn't handle it. He would be awake for days on end. Like, no exaggeration. I mean, he would stay up all night doing things. So I honestly thought that it was like pills. And I think it did actually start out with Adderall. That was the start of the uppers that would keep him awake. And then at some point, I think all of that got too expensive and meth was cheap.
So by the time you really knew what the problem was, mm-hmm. the marriage was already in serious trouble.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. So what put the marriage in serious trouble?
I think there was like a lot of secrecy. His mood changed. He would lash out, which was not him. And I knew he was being deceitful. There was lies upon lies that didn't have anything to do with drugs, but like, it was just little things. And I'm like, what are you trying to tell me? Like, I know this isn't true. But he was so delusional or something that he thought that I would believe it. So this was probably about, when I found him on the couch that morning, it was probably about 4 months after. I mean, and not to mention the amount of money that was missing. I mean, like, that would just come up missing, and you'd always have an excuse for it. And then I found out he got really crafty, and he ended up having some of his paycheck from work put into another account. So I cut him off of my account. Like, I took my, you know, I had my direct deposit for work changed, and to try to keep him out of that, because it would be a point where on Friday mornings, like when we got paid, it would literally be like a race to the bank, because he would go withdraw like all of it. I mean, and it was awful.
Because these are signs. I think this is important. When you say lash out, mm-hmm. what do you mean lash out?
So at some point during the course of this addiction, obviously the relationship became physical. My ex-husband was not one. He would even so much as raise his voice. He was very mild-mannered, very calm. You know, he's really a really relaxed person. So when he started kind of getting, I don't know if it was like, I still struggle with the word abuse, you know, abusive, but he would definitely be physically abusive. I mean, there was times, like, even with the kids, he was never physical with the kids at all. It was just me, but he would, you know, even the kids would kind of be like, you know, what's wrong with him? Like, why is he upset? Or like, why did I get so mad? Just over little things. I don't know, like something wouldn't get done and it would just send him over the edge, like for no reason.
So when you say physically abusive, what yes. are you talking about?
So I think the part that I think at the point when everyone had to find out, unfortunately, I had come home from work one day and I had sold this chair that we had on like Facebook Marketplace or something, right? And had been in the basement, and we were literally just making room because my kids' bedrooms are down there. So I had sold this chair on Facebook Marketplace, and I was going home after work to pick up the chair, and I was meeting the lady with it. And he was at the house again, shouldn't have been. So I said, he was in the garage, and I said, will you carry this chair outside? And he said, yeah. And he just freaked out. I mean, it was a mood changing, something that simple. He goes downstairs, ends up throwing the chair outside. It was awful. He ended up coming after me. The strength of people that are on meth is unreal. He was very strong anyway, but he just kept picking me up. He would pick me up and just throw me down. His thing was keeping me where I was, so he would physically hold me down a lot. So that was his thing. There had been signs before that. He'd kind of come after me for different reasons. He would shut me in the bedroom. He would refuse to let me leave the bedroom, just because he didn't want me. He, in moments of sobriety, like when we, I would have a conversation, I'm like, what is going on? He said that he would always, in his head, he was afraid that I was going to go tell. And I'm like, you understand, I wouldn't even know what to go say. But that was his thing. He thought that I was going to go tell someone. And the day that he came after me, that was so bad. You know, obviously I'll never forget it. But he later told me that he thought that if I left the house that day, that I was going to like call the police or I was going to tell on him. And all I was doing was I was just saying, just let me leave. Just please let me leave. And I was obviously outside because he was in the garage when I went to get the chair. I got inside the house and I tried to shut the door so I could lock the door. And that didn't work out. He came in the house anyway, and it was just awful. But we were inside the house for 4 minutes, and I'm telling you, it felt like 40 minutes. I mean, it was nonstop. By the time when I got back in the house after everything had happened, he had moved the couch, he had moved the ottoman. He kept pushing things in front of me to try to trip me up. And by the time he did catch me, like it was all he would do. He would just physically pick me up, and just drop me. Like it was like I was ragdoll, or hold me down. He would use both of his hands and hold me on the ground because he didn't want me to leave. I eventually got out of the house after 4 minutes. And I know this because it was my doorbell camera caught everything, which was just a whole nother disaster. But I got out of the house, and thank God my neighbor across the street was home. He's a school teacher. He shouldn't have been home. Thank God that he was. And I went over to get in my car, went on the side of my house, trying to go on the far side to get away, to get in my car. And he caught me and grabbed the keys out of my hand and held me on the ground. He was on top of me, physically on top of me, like with his knees in my back so that I couldn't move. And I just remember saying, like, if you don't let me leave, like, I'm going to yell. And he was laughing. Like, he would just laugh hysterically. Even inside, it was just this, when I was just, at one point, I got a tear in my eye. And he was like, are you going to cry? What are you going to do, cry? Like, and he was laughing, and I was so mad. And I was like, because it's not him and what was going through my head. And then I remember as he was holding me down, I told him, like, I'm going to bite you. Like, I started to bite him just in self-defense, obviously. And he was like, he said, you'll be the one in trouble. Like, I won't leave any marks on you, so you'll be the one in trouble when someone comes. And in that moment, like, I was like, oh my gosh, like, what if I am the one who gets in trouble? Like, everything's going through your head, and it's such a fast, like, all these thoughts at once. But I couldn't even, if I, like, a rational me would know that I wouldn't have been the one in trouble. But like, when you're going through it, it was terrible. So I get outside finally, and he has me held on the, and I started to yell, and he tried to cover my mouth so I wouldn't yell. And he was just laughing, because nobody would hear me. But I finally, obviously yelled out enough. My neighbor was outside, and he heard me. He yelled at him to get off of me. And thank God he didn't wait. He did call the police, unfortunately. I tried to get away again. I tried to leave, and he jumped in my car as I'm driving. So I finally just kind of got in front of my neighbor. I went a very small distance in my car and just threw it in park and opened up the driver's door and ran out. And I was able to get to my neighbor's garage. But at that point, the police have been called. I live in a neighborhood. The neighbors know what's going on. One of my good friends' moms was, she lives down the street from me, and her mom was walking down the street. Like, in the matter of minutes, my entire life was turned upside down because everything that I tried to keep such a secret was out.
Why did you try to keep it a secret?
It's embarrassing. Like, no one wants to deal with that. No one wants to admit that they're going through it. I think that's kind of the problem, is that people just keep it quiet, thinking that, he'll get better. Or I really was trying so hard to get out of the situation, just, divorce him, just leave, just have it be over with and just move on. I don't know why I thought that would solve any sort of problem. Obviously, it wasn't going to. But in my head, I was like, if I just can unassociate myself with him, everything will be better.
So from that moment, that whole instance that you just described, mm-hmm. trying to leave, the 4 minutes, the car, the whole thing. Mm-hmm. When you look at that now, what do you think about? What kind of lasting impression has that moment left on you?
I mean, that whole thing was, that day alone was life-changing. I mean, I think about, I think about my kids. I think about, how in the world did I even get in that spot when you're trying so desperately to get out of it? I don't think the magnitude of what had happened hit me until I had to tell my kids that day. My oldest at the time was, 16, 15, just less than 16 probably. And, thank goodness he was not home. Both my oldest and my middle son were at football practice. So I had that little bit of time before they got home. Otherwise they would have been home from school, which would have just been disastrous. And, I can't imagine I hate to think of how that could have gone. But I had to tell them what had happened. Obviously he was, my ex-husband was arrested and he went to jail, domestic violence and, unlawful restraint. He was held, he was charged with both of those things. He pled guilty to both of those things as well. But yeah, like I think I'm lucky, I guess. I mean, I didn't realize I had marks, he left marks and I had bruises and I had cuts and all of that. But when I had to tell my kids and they just lost it, I'm looking at this teenage son of mine who is, otherwise somewhat not unemotional, but he's a teenage boy. He doesn't show a lot of that stuff. And my middle son, who's super emotional, they lost it. And he said, Mom, you're like the only thing we have. Like, what would have happened if something would have happened to you? And I had never really looked at it that way or thought of it that way. I guess I was just kind of in a survival mode and didn't really think about anything else. Like, I knew I was okay. And no matter how many times I told them, like, look, I'm okay, they lost it. And it was terrible. So as a mom, that was the worst.
So telling them that while you have these physical wounds mm-hmm. on you mm-hmm. and this traumatic experience has happened that day, how did that make you feel? We know how they felt.
Terrible.
Terrible.
I felt terrible. I mean, I was ashamed and embarrassed and sad. And I don't know if I was ever scared. I was mad. I was very angry. I mean, for so many different reasons. I didn't want anybody to know this was going on. I didn't want anyone to know this is my life. I'd only shared with a couple of people, a close friend at work. She knew pretty much everything, and I'd shared a little bit with my, maybe my sister, a couple of close friends, but definitely not the extent of what it was, and never really said how bad it actually was. So that was hard.
So the people who now become aware of it because of this public event.
Yeah, like everybody.
Right. What's their response to you? Because obviously, you're at this point, you're not telling people because mm-hmm. you're afraid of mm-hmm. what the response will be. Mm-hmm. So in reality, what is the response?
Oh my gosh, I say mad. They were so upset that I never came to them. They're like, why wouldn't you tell us? What are you thinking? Why are you keeping this to yourself? And, I knew I had a great support system and I knew that I would have a great support system, but it was admitting it. It was really admitting that there was a problem. I knew my close friends would be more than supportive, but I didn't want them to think that I was every day going home to something that was as terrible as what it really was.
See, this is a big issue because this is the story that a lot of people have, is that the other person is flying off the handle for some reason or doing something awful, but for some reason the shame and the embarrassment is on the person who's taking it all.
I know.
Now, what's your best explanation for why that is?
I don't know. Like, looking back, and when I say it, I know how silly it sounds, and that some people I think just don't have a great support system. I did. I was lucky. I did have these people. My mom and my dad and my friends, my sister and brother. They were amazing. But I think it was just a kind of a shame. And like, how did you let your life get there? Like, how did you not know? How has this been going on for so long that you just, I really did just turn a blind eye for so long because I didn't want to believe it. And I thought it would get better and I thought it would stop. And then when I knew it wasn't going to stop, I just thought my answer was I'd rather get out than admit how bad it was. I was just hoping that I could be done with everything before anyone really found out.
So this event happens.
Yes.
He gets charged.
Yes.
Then what happens?
So he goes to jail. He was sentenced to 20 days. He served 5 and was let out, which is, I guess what happens a lot. He goes to his apartment. He has an apartment by this time. It's just a little studio apartment that was set up. And he's lost his job. Like, by this point, he doesn't have a job. His mom paid for his rent. I paid for his rent, mostly because I didn't want him to think he had any reason to come back to the house. Of course, there was like a temporary restraining order put into place for that. And he goes through, this was, the month was October, so he goes through all of October and all of November, and it just got worse. I mean, he was using terribly. I don't even know the amount. I couldn't even begin to guess. The day that he came after me, he did tell me that he had taken more meth than he ever had before and three Percocet about 5 to 10 minutes before I came home. And he said, I was mad that you came home, even though he shouldn't have been there. He was mad that I came home at that point because he was taking stuff to sell it to get more money to go buy more. And I stopped that. So I think in that day, I mean, I really think that if he would have had any more than what he already did, I definitely, I think he would have died. He would have overdosed. He couldn't have handled that. I mean, he admittedly said it was more than he'd ever taken at once. He said what the amount that he took should have lasted him like a week. So
does he have an answer as to what happened to himself? Why this life that went okay for so long all of a sudden went off the tracks?
No, I have no idea. He really doesn't. I mean, I think that he struggled with like, you know, using painkillers when that started. When that kind of became apparent with the sleeping and the things that I kind of called him out on, you know, like, what is going on with you? This isn't you. He did try to, and mind you, this was a whole year prior. You know, this was a year before this incident happened, but he tried to get himself off of that. And I think just to counteract the painkillers and the sleeping and the being down, I think he started taking like Adderall. Like, he would take them both. So he'd be like up, and then I would think he was normal, and then he would take painkillers and go down so he would sleep because he was not sleeping, like I said. At one point in there, which I didn't realize it had been so long, but at one point he went without sleep for 5 straight days. And that will alter a person's mood more than you can imagine.
Now, at some point when you marry somebody, I assume there's love in the relationship.
Of course.
So when did that start to go away?
Not until the addiction. I mean, there was a point, I would say probably, I don't know if the love goes away because there's still a love for that person.
Do you still love them today?
No, I mean, a different kind of love, I suppose. I mean, I want him to be okay. I wish him well. I want him to succeed. I hope that he gets sober. He's had a lot of things since. We've been through a lot since that day that he came after me when everything became public. There's been a lot that's gone on since then. So I hope that he can overcome that. He is the father of my youngest child. So I want him to be better. I want him to be a good person. I want him to be who I know that he can be. But I don't know that I can be a part of that. I need to kind of watch that from afar. You know, I.
How long did it take you to decide that you couldn't go back?
Not long.
Not long.
once things were, I mean, I think because we had all of this leading up to it, I'd already decided, even before, you know, before he came after me, like I'd already made up my mind. And it was about 6 months prior to that, actually. It was in the spring of that year that I knew the marriage was over. And I told him, like, I can't do this. I don't want to live like this. And this was, you know, this is before I even knew how bad things were. But it was the money missing, the lies, the deceit. I mean, all these little things leading up to it, I think kind of knew that it was just a person I couldn't be with. But then when he came after me, like, there was no going back. I mean, that was it.
So is there any emotional connection to this person at this point?
Not really. Like I said, I wish him well. Like, I want him to do good. If there's something that I could do to aid in his recovery, I would. I just don't think that that's the case. I think that we're kind of, I don't think that that's a thing. No, I mean, so much has happened since then. He's away now, so he's hopefully getting better. He's in a court-ordered rehab, so he's getting some pretty extensive treatment, I hope. You know, it's a 4 to 6 month program. He went to rehab actually after the last incident. October, November was really bad. He went to rehab in Columbus. He was there, which was a great place. I did like the family counseling. I met with one of, you know, the people there, and I tried to go through those steps just to be supportive and be that person in his life. He was there for 3 weeks. It was a 21-day program. So he stayed for 3 weeks, and he was good for a little while. And that was, you know, after Christmas time. when he got out, and he was good until he started working and things seemed to be okay. Again, he was still in his apartment, so things seemed to be going in the right direction, but I don't know. They fell off again.
So what have you learned from this situation? What advice would you have to somebody who might be going through this? Because this is a common story now.
It is. It's sad. I think don't wait to say something. You know, I started coping because I started writing. I got my feelings out by writing. I started a blog, which I never intended to share publicly. I shared it with some friends, and then eventually it kind of got out there. The word kind of got out there. And that's how I coped, by writing it down instead of saying it. And I think it needs to be said, which is kind of why I'm here with you. You know, I'm trying to let people know that there is another side of it. You know, there are people that care. And if you don't have the people that care, we can find people that care. Someone will hear your story. Someone will listen. Someone will give you advice. There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of help out there.
Did you ever go to a support group or anything like that?
I did. I went to a local Al-Anon group. One of my friends that literally pushed me to go. She went with me. I put it off for long enough. And then she was like, no, you're going. We're going tonight. And that was definitely life-changing. I would highly encourage anyone to find a support group like that, because the people are amazing. Really are.
How hard is it to cut somebody out of your life who's such a big part of your life?
It was awful. It was very hard. I mean, which is, you know, why I think it lingered on for those like 6-7 months that, you know, I knew it was over, but you can't just, it's hard to just cut ties. You know, you can't just cut them out. You still wish them well. I still care. Like, I'm not heartless. You want them to be okay. There's still, you know, there's still a lot of feelings there. Like, you don't even know how they became who they have become. And, you know, for a long time, I still saw who he was or who I married. So that was really hard.
But do people come and say, how can you have feelings for somebody who did that to you?
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. I got that so much. And you can't even describe it. I mean, it's just one of those things that you want to see the person that they were. I think you're so blinded by that, you know. And there, I remember many times sitting there like, how is this even happening? Like, how did he get to this point? How did I get to this point? How are we here? I think there's just so many feelings that I can't describe, because I know I've looked at these people before that are in like maybe abusive relationships or situations, like, how could you stay? Why are you doing that? And I get it. It's bizarre, but I get it. And yet it's like, you always think that they're going to get better. Like, you remember the part of them that was okay. You know, without help, they're not going to get better. That's just the bottom line.
It's interesting, because the theme there of why you stayed seems to be, or at least the thing that's come up the most, is I didn't want people to know.
Yeah.
I would be embarrassed.
That's true.
Why?
I don't know why. I mean, I know that, like, at least a large part of that, I didn't want my kids' friends to know. We live in a small community, of course, and the minute somebody finds out that, you know, Luke's stepdad is doing this, or Owen's dad is, you know, that's terrible. You don't want that for your kids. So I thought if I could keep it quiet and just get out, you know, a divorce would be less painful for them than everything, you know, other rumors or things that were getting out there. And of course, that just backfired. But I think that, you know, the kids are good. They really... You know, they weren't, the drug abuse was never like brought in front of them. So thank God for that. They didn't have to see things. They didn't have to go through that. They saw, what I went through was definitely hard enough. Again, this continued to go on in the springtime of last year. He was still, again, when he started using, he came after me a few times. So that was bad.
Came after. Now, what do you,
so,
'cause at this point you're not together.
We're not together. No, we're not together. So, like, I was an idiot, so I thought that it would be okay. He was moving from one apartment to the next apartment, and there was a 3-week period where he couldn't be in one apartment, so he wanted to stay at the house, which just made sense. He was sober at the time, so we thought it made sense. I was like, that's fine. So we tried that, and that was not smart. And this was like last February, March. That was dumb. But again, he was sober, and I had seen the person that I thought that he was, and I'm like, we can do this. It's fine, because we could get along. You know, it wasn't that we couldn't get along. We could get along at that point.
So why was that dumb?
Because I think it just enabled him. It enabled him to, you know, use again. It was maybe we're just, I don't know. Maybe it was the stress of, you know, inevitably at this point, like, I'd already spoken to the lawyer about divorce. It wasn't like that he didn't know this was coming. We knew it was coming. So I think it was just emotionally too much for him, or maybe, I don't know what it was. He was working at the time, so that was okay. But yeah, so he kind of went back to the same thing. He, you know, would kind of shut me in the bedroom and make sure I stayed there, which was awful.
So at that point, after going through that horrendous event,
yeah,
and this is going on, he's there again, and you're being shut in the bedroom again.
Yeah.
What are you thinking now?
I'm stupid. I'm thinking, what was I thinking? Like, why was this okay? But I mean, truly, he was sober, and like a couple of weeks should have been fine. For anybody else, it would have been fine. Like, we had been very honest. I knew that he did not want the divorce, but he knew that I did, and I was very adamant, and I had moved forward. And you know, I really felt like the rational side of him, and he was like, when we could talk about it rationally, like he really knew. Okay, like, we're not together. He knew all of that, so I felt comfortable with like just having a relationship in which we could get along, co-parent, you know, and be okay.
So without diving too deep on this, just to give a frame of reference, when you have him come back for 3 months, which is only...
No, 3 weeks.
It was
supposed to be like 3 weeks.
3 weeks.
Yes.
When you have him come back for 3 weeks, now at this point, is the relationship strictly no marriage, no feelings, totally platonic?
Yeah. Yeah, we were definitely just trying to get along. I mean, we're just trying to make it... Yeah, no, there was no, it was not a marriage type situation at all.
Now, did he understand that?
Yeah, he did. And he did. I mean, I definitely, like, if given the opportunity, he probably would have, you know, wanted more or wanted to try to make it work. I mean, he did say that, but I was very adamant. And like I said, a rational him, an unaltered him, someone who wasn't using drugs, we could have that conversation and say, you know, like, this isn't work. And he would say it to you, okay, you know, maybe we are just... toxic. Maybe it's just not going to work. Like, we could have those conversations. So I felt okay about it. We were on the same page for a while prior to him, you know, coming back to stay for like 3 weeks.
Have you forgiven him, really?
I don't know. Probably not. I mean, I struggle with that, I think, like, because I don't know. It changed everything. It changed the way I think about things. It changed the way I look at things. It changed, I think, the way my kids feel about certain things, which I just kind of detest him for. Like, I don't want that in their lives. I don't want them to be... They worry about me. I mean, for months. I mean, my middle son would call me every day. I was on the phone with him, actually, when I got home the day that everything came out. He had just gotten out of school and was headed to football practice, and he called me about something. And I was on the phone with him as I was, you know, pulling into the driveway. So he... In his head, I mean, he said to me many times, he was like, Mom, what if that was the last time I would have talked to you? 4 months, this child called me every day at 3 o'clock just to see if I was okay.
How does that make you feel?
Awful. It was terrible. As a mom, like, I felt terrible. You know, I mean, that he needed to call and check on me. That's not the way it's supposed to go.
You say it's changed you.
Yeah.
How has it changed you?
I mean, I suppose I'm... a little less trusting. I have a lot of insecurities as far as, you know, I guess people in general.
Such as?
I don't know. I've kind of developed this attitude, and it's terrible, but like nothing anyone could ever do to me would surprise me ever. You know, and I think that's a terrible place to be in. Like, I don't want to think that of people. I don't want to think that anybody's capable of terrible things at any given time, but I definitely have that kind of skewed view.
Do you think you can ever be the person you were before this all happened?
I mean, I hope so, but I don't know. And I don't know if I want to be that person. Like, I think I appreciate the fact that, unfortunately, I went through something terrible, but I don't want to be so blinded again that, you know, that I let myself get into a situation like that. To this day, I don't even know how it happened. I don't know.
Are you leery now of things in the future?
You mean like relationships?
Yeah.
Or, I don't know, not really. I mean, I think that I think that good people are out there, and I think that there's good things, and you know, maybe all of this is pointing me in the right direction.
Does it make you second guess yourself?
Oh, 100%.
Did you used to second guess yourself?
No, I was pretty confident. I mean, I guess second guess myself, and it makes me second guess other people a lot. I think, you know, like, are their intentions true, or, you know, those kind of things, because I was, you know, I was pretty sure that, like, he wasn't going to be that way. So I guess I feel like, you know, maybe my, I don't, don't know if I didn't trust my gut. Maybe I need to go with my gut more, use my heart less. I don't know.
So this was a decision based on your heart, not your gut.
Probably, yeah.
In fear of what others would think. How many people do you think are listening right now who are not making life decisions because of how other people would see it?
I definitely think I was alone in that. I mean, I think that's why people stay in bad situations. I mean, you can say, you know, maybe it's because you don't want, you know, the kids or this or that. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think it's, you know, definitely a perception.
And what do you think the perception is of you at this point?
I have no idea.
Well, from the people who you cared about.
I hope they're like, I hope people, you know, perceive me as someone who did just kind of overcome, who kind of just kept pushing forward and who, you know, saw the other side of it and, you know, who got out of a really terrible situation and is trying to make it better, you know, trying to make my life better, trying to speak out so other people feel comfortable speaking out. I think that's, I guess, I don't know. I hope they perceive that anyway.
What is your advice to somebody now who might be going through this?
Well, if they're in the situation and their person is not willing to get help, professionally, extensive help, they're not going to get better. It's not a disease that you can beat on your own. Addiction is terrible. It's impossible. It's impossible to handle on your own. I'm convinced. You know, they may try to get sober. They may be sober for days or for a couple of weeks. But I think long term, it needs professional, you know, intervention.
Do you have any regrets when you look back at it now?
Well, I mean, probably. I think I stayed too long. I think I didn't talk. I think I didn't get out when I should have. I think there was a lot of things that I should have done differently. But I'm pretty proud of where I'm at now, I guess.
So when this comes up in the history of your life, uh-huh, and let's say we hope for his sake that he gets better.
Yes.
Can you forgive him?
Yes.
You say you can.
I can.
You haven't yet, but
not fully. Like, I think definitely, I definitely think parts of me have forgiven maybe. I don't know. I'm still pretty angry with him, you know. I think when you're, you know, married to someone like that, if he would have just ever said, like, I'm getting into this position that I, you know, I'm using and I can't get out. But, like, he never said that. Like, I would have 100% stood by his side and, I think, tried to help. But when it gets to the point where there's so much lies and deception and mistrust, when all of that enters in, it kills the marriage. I mean, I think if early on he would have said, I need help, I would have not judged the person at all. I think I would have really stayed and tried to help.
It's interesting, again, because we go back and we look at fear of what other people would think. You're still very angry at him till this day. These are emotions. What has it done to you emotionally?
My emotions are pretty much all over the map. Like, I know that I think you're getting at the fact that I tell Scott that I don't cry. Like, there are certain things that I don't cry over. Like,
why don't you cry?
Because I cried for so long. Like, I cried for, like, I think I just got tired of it. You know, like, crying doesn't help anything. Like, you know, didn't you ever hear that? What, like, there's no crying in baseball, Scott. Like,
but ultimately there is.
There is. There are. There was a lot of tears. There was a lot of emotion. Like, and I still get emotional about things. But, you know, I think that I got in this mindset of, like, just move forward. Just keep going. Like, there's no time for tears. There's no time for, like, dealing with your emotions. Like, get up. Get better. You know.
Do you think that's healthy as you say that?
It's probably not healthy, but I don't know. I think shutting off some of that for a long time was the only thing that I could do. Because if I let myself get down in that hole, like, there's days even now, like, I could totally just stay in bed and forget it all. And I don't think that that's uncommon. I think a lot of people have that feeling, but I think you need to find that strength. I think I had to shut off a certain part of my feelings just to cope. I mean, just to move forward, just to keep seeing what, like, keep your eye on the prize. You know, I had to know that there was something better for myself, for my kids. I had to get through it. So, yeah. I mean, maybe it wasn't healthy. Maybe it wasn't the best thing to do. But I had times where I could be emotional. When I went to these support meetings, I could be emotional. I could tell them what I felt because all these people had either been there, were going through it. Like, I was either, you know, a step ahead or a step behind all these people that were there.
What part would bring out the emotion?
I think I felt so relieved that someone else knew what I was going through. I think I would, anything to do with my kids brought out emotion, their well-being, their, which they were, you know, they were, gosh, they're such little troopers. So yeah, I think that now when I look back, I get emotional, maybe a little bit, like that I'm finally out of it. I can see the other side. It all happened so fast, but it seems like so long. Does that make sense? Like it took forever to get out of, but in the grand length of lifetime, it really wasn't a long period of time.
Do you have any fears?
About what?
Anything tied with this at this point.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I do have fears. I'm worried about what's going to happen when he gets out of his rehab. Like, I hope he's better, and I hope that it's all just, I'm fearful for nothing, but I have real fears about that, and it's getting close, you know? So I'm very concerned, not necessarily for my safety, but for how I'm going to handle it, what's going to happen when I do see him, what's going to happen when I do talk to him. We're going to have to cross that bridge at some point, and I don't know if I'm really prepared for that.
I guess we'll all find out.
We'll
find out. Now, if people would like to read your blog, which is public, how would they do that?
So it's www.mysobertrip.com.
And they go there, do they have to search your name or anything in particular?
That takes you right to it. Yep.
My Sober. In one word, how would you describe yourself now, today?
Strong.
That's the word.
That's it.
That's the adjective. Well, I can't thank you enough for coming in. We had a lot of fun in the first hour. This was fun, too, because I think this will help people, and people will hear this, and I think a lot of people are going through it. And it's a tough thing to open up about. I don't know if it was tough for you, but it would be tough for a lot of people. I thank you for doing it, and you're going to be speaking to a big group later on this month about the very same thing.
I am, yes.
Which is very cool, because it will help people.
I hope so.
And I guess that's one of the better things that can come out of this, is helping other people.
Right.
With all, would you call it a tragedy? I don't want to call it something it's not.
I don't know if it's, I mean, a life-changing event.
Life-changing event.
Tragedy, yeah.
And that's all the time I have today. We thank Abby Croman for coming in. Charlie Evers will be on in 10 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
He's really not helping at all. He's not showing up. I don't know what this guy's problem is. You know what I'm saying? I mean, he's got a supercut haircut. He has a terrible suit on. I could really, really help this guy out, but I have to tell you something. I am not going to help him because he's not helping me. And I'm a very nice guy, but he is not being nice to me.
Well, Donald, that was on my list of things to ask you about because he...
So I had to get right to it because I just cannot get over that he's doing this. It makes no sense.
Well, he said, and this is his quote, he said, I'm going to get Kasich's quote right here. He says, "Why would I feel compelled to support someone whose positions I kind of fundamentally disagree with?"
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, but doesn't he know we're in the same party? I mean, Mike Pence and I don't acknowledge. He's my VP. And then I was thinking about Chris Christie, who I've mentioned many, many times before. I like Chris. He gets my dry cleaning. He gets, you know, fast food for it. He just runs all these amazing errands. You know, he'll shut down an entire bridge just to get us some Chinese food. It's really, really incredible. I have to say that. But, you know, the, and I...